This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This fall, public schools in Northwest Indiana, as well as the rest of the Hoosier State, are going to be getting ready for classes, and many of them are emphasizing the idea of remote learning. And as the digital divide here in the Hoosier State is continuing, it may have a big impact more so on how online education is going to be for thousands of school-aged youngsters. And then there's a new report that is out from Ball State University that gives us some surprising, maybe for some, but not surprising for ones who have been watching this problem for a long time, and it's just been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. Professor Mike Hicks, who is the director of the Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Research, and his team have been working on this subject, and he is with us to talk about the results of the report that is out this past week. And Professor Hicks, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, good to be with you again.
Now, we've talked about this, I guess, in separate occasions about the digital divide and how the problem of access for Hoosiers to the internet and its services has been, and the impact economically primarily, but there's an educational impact, and we're starting to see that now, aren't we?
Yes, and our study looked at one aspect of this digital divide, which is what share of children in the Hoosier State do not have access to any internet. There are other versions of the digital divide, how many don't have access to broadband or sufficient download and upload speed to do Zoom, and then how many who have access maybe don't have the computing technology available from the school to or at home to do the type of work that is appropriate for their age level.
Now, how did you and your research team that worked on this happen to go about finding all the information? Did you break it out by not only the community size, the school areas that might be affected, and the youngsters as well?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of ways to do this, and without getting into all the detail, there are data from the American Community Survey, which is a census product, as well as microdata about individual students distributed across the state to tell us what households have internet access based on survey questions over several years, usually a five-year period. And then we have this sample of Hoosiers. We have some idea where they're at, but it's detail about their income, their family demographics, and those sorts of things that we use to try to understand who it was in the state that was most affected by this absence of any sort of internet at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, in general, what did you find in the study about how many Indiana school-age youngsters actually have any internet access at home?
Right. So there are about 42,000 households with children that don't have any access in Indiana. That's about 6.5%. And so there's a range of estimates there. Between 68,000 and 84,000 school-age children don't have any access to internet at home.
Mm-hmm.
And then those are distributed across the state. Of course, every school corporation has at least one of these families. But they're most concentrated in the very rural places where broadband and internet is not readily accessible outside of like a dial-up service. And then in more urban places that concentrate people with poverty, so Indianapolis and Northwest Indiana as well. So mm-hmm. Those two places are more geographically attenuated to this problem.
Now, in finding out where all of these discrepancies and disparities happen to be, did that happen to show up as well, too, in the quantity as well as the quality of education that the school-age youngsters are getting?
Well, we haven't gone that far yet, but it stands to reason if you look back at what we experienced in the latter half of 2020 spring school year.
Mm-hmm.
School ended really about the 13th to the 15th for all Indiana kids. And from that point onwards, either you were able to continue online learning like my son did. I have one still in high school. And most schools have either one-to-one or near one-to-one distribution of technology, at least for older children, you know, middle school and older. But what this means is that at least one of every 15 kids had no access to that. If they were to learn, they were either going to have to, you know, break social distancing, go to another family, or do schooling through the mail, which is obviously not. It's a much more complex process to deliver lectures through the mail than it is through Zoom. So there's a large share of students that are missing out. And the the problem that we have retrospectively is that it looks like, you know, the households that don't have internet access are the ones you'd expect. They're more likely to be single parent, low income households, or those that struggle with English as a primary language. And those are the children that we face the biggest educational challenges to begin with. So what we're just doing is exacerbating the educational problems of our most vulnerable students in the state.
Did we find that the coronavirus pandemic actually have a serious impact on how, in turn, it's, I guess, the digital divide shows how important it really and unfortunately it is that for students here in Indiana?
You know, it's clear that, yes, there's a problem. The magnitude of the problem isn't yet known. We won't really know it until we're able to get those kids back into the classroom this fall, be able to expose them to whatever they missed last spring because of closure, and then assess them down the road to see if any of the loss of learning is more permanent. So there are a couple of places where this is really bad. You know, kids changing schools, going from elementary to middle to high school this fall might find some challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the early years, we know that just the loss of learning over the summer is acute. Summer is 2 months. Now we're talking about 5-6 months for some kids. Even if they go back in person, and we know that there are a number of schools that are not going back in person, they're extending digital learning this fall, and we don't know how many may have to go to digital learning because of the uncontrolled spread of COVID-19 in the state.
We're talking with Professor Mike Hicks, who is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University, about this recent study that is out here just showing how important it is to try to deal with the digital divide, even though we're in the midst of a pandemic, because of the impact it has on school-age youngsters here in the Hoosier State. And now, since the center has a lot of information that goes out that has some impact, certainly, on what ends up being reviewed by state legislators, is there any advice that's come out of this from your research team for them to try to help deal with the problem and try to make those changes faster to the internet access around the state?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are several things that we explicitly or implicitly recommend. And the first one is that, you know, there are two types of unfunded liabilities for a state. One is that you make a promise to someone with a pension fund and you don't fund it. The other one is that you have an obligation of government, in this case it's a constitutional obligation, to provide a fair and equitable education that isn't funded. And so I think we have, because of ongoing digital divide problems, an unfunded liability that is going to continue to cost us way down the road. I mean, I don't know how many kids are affected. I don't know what this will have done to college and high school completion. I don't know what this will do to reading rates. But it stands to reason it's going to be negative across the board for children. So even kids that are doing well will have felt some sort of shock because of this. And so that's going to demand additional resources down the road to remediate kids. And I don't know if it's 30% of kids. I'd say that's on the low end, 60 or 75% maybe high end. And that's really going to be a challenge to prevent some lasting damage to a generation of kids.
Do you think this is going to have an advantage for school districts when superintendents have to talk with their local legislators about making sure that the help is out there to improve the services for internet access for their youngsters in their particular districts? And we're talking now about every school district in the state of Indiana is going to be hitting up the General Assembly for help.
Right. I mean, I think it stands to reason that we were having significant challenges appropriately funding K-12 before the pandemic. It's much worse now. And, you know, I think this has two different impacts. One is providing evidence that there is a challenge. Schools know how many kids aren't responding, don't have internet access, aren't able to access learning at home. This sort of provides a full-scale view of that for the entire state. And the second thing it does is it sort of ought to signal to legislators that the debates over, you know, how vigorously we try to reduce the spread of COVID are not just some short-term political shenanigans. It's not, make-believe. This is going to have long-term effects on the educational attainment of children in Indiana. And we will, I guarantee you, there are kids that didn't learn to read, that aren't prepared to go into the next grade, that are doing so because we didn't really have a choice last spring. And that's going to be with us for a long time. And I think an important issue for the General Assembly to listen to teachers and schools about what they need, because I certainly don't know, but, but what do they need to get students up to speed so they're not left behind from COVID?
Now, I know this particular report doesn't bring it up, but we know, as an economist, you certainly know that there is an impact on the economy in Indiana, and in particular how businesses are able to deal with it. And we're talking here about educating people that are going to end up wanting to work for employers out there. This is going to have a problem for them, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's just say it flat. Indiana ranks 38th in the country in educational attainment. It's the number one problem that is causing long-term slow growth in Indiana, and it is the problem that is driving people away from big portions of the state and out of the state. And so this simply makes it worse, and it's maybe not, we're not as bad as some extraordinarily rural states like Mississippi, but, you know, when Indiana is now has to compare itself to, say, Mississippi or West Virginia in terms of the quality of education it's delivering, that's not the place that we need to be. We need to be thinking about, you know, being in the top third in terms of educational attainment. And this COVID crisis has revealed rather than caused some weaknesses in our ability to deliver schooling to particularly the most vulnerable kids around the state.
Now, this report's come out from the Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Research, is available on the CBER's website, which is within bsu.edu. Check it out if you'd like to get more information about this as well. And what we look at here is what's going to happen in the months ahead as we're dealing not only with the coronavirus pandemic, but youngsters going back into school one way or the other. And we know that's going to be a big problem, to be sure, for online learning, whatever it may happen to be, or for virtual learning, as the school districts happen to choose. And Professor Hicks, thank you for joining us. Give us the update, and we hope that we'll find out some more soon, and maybe we'll get some action from lawmakers further about this problem come next year.
Thank you very much.
Michael Hicks is the director of the Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Research. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Esther Stiles is a board member for the LaPorte County PFLAG group, which is a group that is supportive of young gay, lesbian, and transgender people in the community. And that is how we find out more about an organization which is relatively new, which is entitled Out in LaPorte. And Esther Stiles is with us. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, how did you get involved in Out in LaPorte, and what is the group really all about?
So I got involved with Out in LaPorte, honestly, because I just saw that they were a new group that started in LaPorte City. I noticed it on Facebook, and I'm a resident of LaPorte City, also an out lesbian in LaPorte County, or sorry, LaPorte City. And so I just connected with them to find out more about them and, you know, learn how I could get involved. Our goal as an organization really is to not only be a resource for the LGBTQ community in LaPorte, but also a resource for education, training, for, you know, the schools, for the city administration, you know, just to provide information and resources for folks who are curious or interested, in being a support, or youth who need support. That is one of our primary goals, is to help put together resources in LaPorte for LGBTQ youth who maybe don't have any support, whether they don't have support through their family or through their school. That's one of our primary goals.
I know there are probably no numbers. You don't take this information down necessarily like statistics that go out for the census, but are there a lot of young people and just folks in general in LaPorte County and in the community of LaPorte that are concerned about their gender orientation or their identity?
There's probably a lot more than we realize. Nationally, the average is 6 to 8%. And so if we apply that number to LaPorte with our city population, we're probably looking between somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 individuals. And just like you said, you know, there's no survey or data collection to get actual numbers, so we can't say for sure, but that's probably the average that we're looking at for LaPorte.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are organizations that are similar, that are elsewhere or close by, certainly, and they're maybe linked together because you have folks that might happen to be members in other communities as well. But is there a common bond that you note between not only the folks in LaPorte and the rest of LaPorte County, but maybe some of the surrounding counties here in Northwest Indiana about helping others out who need the help, that have questions, concerns, maybe are a little afraid of things?
I would say there's definitely been a growing support in Northwest Indiana over the last probably 5 or 6 years. That's kind of really when I got started in either talking to other folks to see if they were interested in putting something together for LaPorte. And that is sort of how PFLAG LaPorte County came about, was other folks who were interested in trying to put that together. And, you know, we did the formal, so PFLAG is a national organization.
Right.
And to be a chapter, we had to go through paperwork and designate board members, that sort of thing. And I know there have been a few other PFLAG chapters that have been developed since that time in Porter County, maybe even Lake County. I know there's another organization in Porter County, Northwest Indiana LGBTQ Alliance or something. And so I know they have also worked on putting together a few different types of support networks for LGBTQ youth, folks who identify as transgender, things like that, as well as both organizations have worked to put together Pride events during the month of June this summer. So we've had a couple of those recently.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
I know the coronavirus pandemic's made it very, very difficult for everybody to be able
good.
To get together, other than just either virtually or online one way or the other,
mm-hmm.
rather than in person. But when you do get to talk, whether it happens to be by Zoom or whatever method it happens to be, is there any, maybe one concern, perhaps not, but maybe a group of concerns that you all have about the situation, particularly as it happens in LaPorte?
So I think in general, it is just around, I'm trying to think of how to phrase it best, really just around support in general.
Mm-hmm.
I think some individuals have certainly experienced either harassment or, you know, threatening comments. Nothing that, as far as I'm aware, has risen to the level of being reported or even rising to be investigated by the Indiana Civil Rights Commission. But certainly, because Indiana is not a state that has any kind of hate crime statute or statewide protections for LGBTQ individuals, I think that's always a concern across the state, so not just in LaPorte. Or if, for example, you know, in talking about COVID with folks struggling to work, the possibility of evictions, Indiana doesn't currently have any protections that says, you know, a landlord can't kick someone out because they find out they're gay or transgender.
Right.
There's no protections to say an employer can't fire someone because they, you know, discover that they're gay or transgender. So that's always a worry in the back of many folks' minds. I don't know, you know, like I said earlier, that's been a specific issue recently in LaPorte, but that worry is always there for sure.
And I know with PFLAG, the support that they give are we mentioned earlier, primarily for young people, because they are the ones that are the most affected by any of the discrimination or comments that are made. And I know there's a great concern because those are also the youngest people that are susceptible to suicide and harm of some kind, not only from others, but to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sadly, we do, the LGBTQ community does have one of the highest rates of suicide ideation and also homelessness, because typically, you know, if a caregiver or parent finds out that their child is gay or transgender and it's not something that they understand or even support, then they're likely to kick them out or disown them. And that suicide ideation often comes from a lack of belonging.
Mm-hmm.
So I think typically people think that, you know, it comes with wrestling with the fact that they're gay or transgender, and it's And certainly that can be true, but because of the disconnect from family and community.
Are there opportunities that come up, even though we're focusing on the group because it's out in LaPorte, any opportunities that come up to be able to work with similar groups or individuals that live, say, in Michigan City that are able to help you out and get the word out, explain to people what it's all about?
So I think that that's going to be a growing focus and trend across the county for mm-hmm. sure. PFLAG has, even though we cover all of LaPorte County, it certainly has been more active in Michigan City because folks have been a little more engaged there. We are looking, hopefully, to widen that circle and include folks in LaPorte and include other sites that make that support more accessible for LaPorte City and for folks in the county. For Heights, Union Mills, places that definitely require more transportation and that don't have the same kind of support that you might find in one of the larger municipalities in the county.
Now, if anybody's interested in learning more about Out in LaPorte or getting involved in the organization, how can they do that?
The best way to find us is on Facebook. The group is a public group, so you can just put that in the search bar on Facebook. The administrators of the group, check if there's folks who are interested in connecting one of us, they can just post that to the group and one of us will reach out to them for sure. But that's probably the easiest way to connect.
Esther Stiles is a LaPorte County PFLAG board member, and she's very active as well in the group, which is called Out in LaPorte. And Esther, thank you for being with us to talk about the organization. And we hope that we've shed light on the group as well as encouraged people that want to know more that can get hold of you.
Thank you, Chris. It was a joy talking to you.
The Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute recently put out the announcement of the completion of a lengthy, and we say lengthy because it was over a number of years, a study of how local governments include schools as well as parks and city halls, town halls and the like are able to pay for the services and provide the services to Hoosiers and in turn how they're getting their money to be able to pay for all of those services that they offer. And the team that put up together this independent fiscal analysis is with us, at least the leader of the team is with us, Purdue University economist Larry DeBoer. And Professor DeBoer, thank you as always for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. Good to be with you again.
Thanks for being with us, because this is a very interesting situation. I know that because we are still dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, we can blame it for a lot of things. We can't blame it for this particular report, because you worked on it for so long with your colleagues, but you do have some interesting notes that you put into it that have something to do with the effects of the pandemic on local government. Tell us first about how the entire, which is now 46 pages in length, all came together for the study.
Yeah, it did get longer than I thought it would. Mm-hmm. And the data was just singing to me, Chris. What can I tell you?
Well, you're going back from to 2002, I guess, and there's a reason that you went back then, right?
That's right. First of all, what we're trying to measure here is what I call a capacity cost index, and we're trying to come up with a comparison of the revenue-raising ability of local governments to the costs they face to deliver services to their population. And this is a measure that tries to be apart from any of the individual decisions that local governments make. So looks at the sort of foundational economic and demographic situation for each of the county's local governments, or for all of the counties in Indiana. We looked at 2002 and 2018 because over that period of time, the state of Indiana changed just about every major feature of local government budgeting and finance. We did a vast reform of our property tax. We reformed our local income taxes. We reform our state school funding formula every budget year. And amazingly, we even reformed the road funding formula from the state. And so one of the things we wanted to do was to compare 2002 to 2018, before all the reforms started and after all the reforms were in place, to see how those changes affected local governments.
What are some of the important points that, I guess, the talking points that would go into like an executive summary? You referred to one in particular, which I guess was this definition of what the capacity cost index is, because it's really something simple, isn't it? It doesn't seem to be in its terminology, but it is a pretty simple idea, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. And, you know, it's nothing new. This sort of thing has been done in the past in a number of studies, and I just applied it to Indiana. So what we're doing is saying, hey, how much revenue could each county, all the local governments in the county, raise if they used the average tax rates from across the state for average property tax rates, average local income tax rates, and then how much would they receive and do they receive from state school aid formula and the state road aid formula? So that would give you at average rates, if each county behaved in an average way, how much revenue would they raise? And then suppose they delivered an average set of services with average costs to their total population and to the population in cities and towns and to their school enrollment. And suppose they maintained their county and city roads at the average rate, how much would it cost? And so by doing those calculations, you can compare the revenue that's available at average rate to the costs that must be paid at average levels and see who's got the capacity to pay for an average level of services and who doesn't. And so it's a way of coming up with of this underlying index of fiscal conditions for the 92 counties.
Did you all find that the situation is different for we'll say urban counties like Lake County and Marion County and Indianapolis and some of the collar counties that are around, which are kind of more urban than they are rural, than the ones that are growing, which are definitely like the ones around Indianapolis and some places elsewhere in the state, and then you've got your rural counties in general, for example, like Newton County or Jasper County.
Yeah, there were quite stark differences among the counties. One of the things we did was in Indiana was to reduce the capacity of the property tax over the period 2002 to 2018, especially by introducing great big new deductions for homeowners. And of course, the point of this was to reduce property taxes for homeowners. And so, there's reason to do it. But on the other side of the budget, it means that less revenue can be raised in places where there are a lot of homes. Where are there a lot of homes? There are a lot of homes in urban areas. And so it kind of knocked out one of the, or at least some of the tax base that urban areas could draw upon. On the other hand, in rural areas, one of the things we did with the reform was to tax farmland at much higher rates. Now, this was quite unfortunate for the farmland owners, I'm inclined to say, given that I work for the College of Agriculture, but as far as the taxes in rural areas, it meant that there was a bigger capacity to draw upon, and it meant that the same services could be provided at lower tax rates in rural areas. And so you had that contrast between what happened in urban areas and what happened in rural areas. And over that period of time, from 2002 to 2018, the capacity cost indexes of rural areas actually improved and of urban areas generally got worse.
So it sounds like actually the farmers staying put, keeping their land up, and if they can afford to do so to expand their acreage, seem to come out in the plus column here as opposed to somebody who lives in town.
Well, the farmers themselves are paying more.
Yeah,
so sneak around that issue there. The reason the capacity has gone up is we gave local governments the ability to tax farmland owners at higher rates. And so we did that, but that obviously increases the capacity of rural governments to raise the revenue. And, the change towards market value assessment that began in 2003, and that Lake County played such a big role in, had that impact on the urban and rural counties.
What do we have to look forward to as far as the changes because of lost jobs? In particular, there's some counties I know in the state that have lost a lot of jobs. They may have shifted to other counties, but they're still considered as lost employment, so that those counties and those local governments aren't getting the revenue back.
Yeah, that was one of the main findings of the study, and it had to do with manufacturing employment. There's a swath of counties running from Kokomo to Richmond, if you think of that area sort of northeast of Indianapolis there, that includes Muncie and as I said, Kokomo and Richmond and places like that. They all had a big negative capacity cost indexes, and those were the places that lost the most manufacturing employment over the long haul between 1972 and 2017. Now, there were a scattering of counties elsewhere that were also in that boat, and one of them was Lake. Mm-hmm. Lake County, of course, was one, and still is, one of the big manufacturing counties in the state. But back in 1972, 40% of Lake's employment was in manufacturing, and now it's 10%. So that's a great big change. And, you know, losing all that manufacturing tax base, both the high-wage jobs and the assessed value of all that equipment, really put a damper on the capacity of these places to raise revenue. And yet, a place like Lake has so many people, over 90% of the population living in cities and towns, which are higher cost places. And you know, when people live elbow to elbow and shoulder to shoulder, the public service costs are greater. But those cities developed on the foundation of manufacturing employment that just isn't there anymore. And that's one of the sources of Lake's problem and the problem in the what I call the old industrial corridor from Kokomo to Richmond.
We're talking with Purdue University economist Larry DeBoer. Larry and his colleagues have worked together with the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, putting out a major report, a look at the tax structure in Indiana, how it seems to compare from county to county. And we're talking in this case between urban counties to counties that are growing very rapidly because of people moving in or businesses moving in, whichever the case may be, I suppose, and rural counties. And now we have the COVID-19 pandemic that seems to be mucking up the works for everybody, it seems. And I know that you and your team had a chance to focus in very seriously on the impact that the recession is having on business and industry and residents at all in Indiana, hasn't it?
That's right. And it is beginning to be a serious problem, and it's going to be a very serious problem. If you think about the tax bases that we looked at in this study, property tax, right? It's based on the assessed value of property. And our assessment system now captures declines in property value. And we expect in a recession, property values to go down. So for the tax year 2022, we would expect assessed value to be lower. And that will make for either lower spending or higher tax rates. Incomes, of course, will go down. That will also affect local governments in 2022. Will the state be able to maintain full school aid? Governor says yes, and let's hope they do. But that means that the budget that they write next year is probably going to have a smaller increase in school aid than we had hoped for. And state road aid, which is based on motor fuel tax collections, that's already down considerably for local governments. So all of those major revenue sources, and those sources together make up more than 80% of the total revenue of local governments, all of them are down, are going to be down within the next couple of years as a result of the recession. Now, you know, our study is a kind of long-term foundational study, but what it says is that places that have negative capacity cost indexes usually have higher property tax rates. Their property tax rates are likely to rise more as a result of this recession. And under our tax cap credit system, those folks will lose more revenue than will the rural folks to those tax cap credits, which are, of course, attempts to hold property taxes down for local taxpayers.
But I guess for the entire state overall, it's still going to be a very, very rough go for a while for town and city governments just to keep up the basic services, won't it?
Yeah, it really will. And that was true in the last recession, which we call the Great Recession. And, you know, it's certainly possible this recession will be even deeper than that. So, it's going to be a tough time for all of our local governments.
Now, what does it seem from your estimation, based on the information that you turned over to the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, that they're going to be able to recommend to the General Assembly? Because we know that a number of changes, as it has happened already, we're talking here about tax caps in the past, and we're talking about changing the school funding formula and a lot of other things, about how the road work in Indiana is paid for these days. And, you know, what's going to happen with lawmakers? How are they going to be advised what they need to do to help keep things going?
That's a good question. And, you know, we didn't make any policy recommendations on this thing. We're simply trying to get the lay of the land in a way. You know, we made these reforms over the last 20 years, and we wanted to step back and say, okay, what do we got? What works? What doesn't work? What causes some places to have positive indexes, to have enough capacity to pay for their services, and what causes other places not to? And I think the study points out a couple of things. And this doesn't mean that anybody's going to make any changes in these things, because there are certainly reasons for their adoption. But we've got a maximum levy, for example, a maximum amount of property taxes that can be raised. And that maximum levy rises by 3 to 4% every year. And what it means is, if you're a rapidly growing area, you cannot raise your property tax revenue in proportion to the increase in your population and the increase in your costs. And so rapidly growing areas can have difficulty. We put in these great big deductions for homeowners to hold down their taxes. And, you know, that's a good reason for doing that. But it means that when population grows, the tax base doesn't rise in proportion to the cost. So one of the things I think we pointed out was that our system isn't entirely friendly to places that are actually growing rapidly. But that doesn't mean that it's friendly to places that are declining rapidly either. You know, in a rural area, when a place declines, the costs don't necessarily go down. You still have to maintain all the roads, for example. So you got fewer people paying taxes and just the same mileage of roads to maintain. And so costs per person can actually rise as well in a place where population is going down. Turns out that our system treats places with sort of modest increases in population most favorably.
Well, that shows once again, too, that the rural counties may have a loss of revenue, and you say that the costs of road have to still be maintained because all those folks in the small communities may not have their supermarket open any longer, which means, like, for example, in your case there here in West Central Indiana, that the residents in Benton County have to drive all the way into Tippecanoe County to go shopping. And, you know, the more of those people are going to have to do it, they're going to wear the roads out faster, I suppose.
Well, that's right. You know, just because you don't have as many people, you know, think about it this way. You know, when people move into a county, they tend to create whole new neighborhoods. All right. But when people move out, they move from here and there and here and there. And, you know, you can't simply turn a road back into pasture land because people are still living in all of those places. And so you still got to have roads at the very least going from the southern border to the northern border and the eastern border to the western border so people can travel through. So as population declines, road costs don't decline. And yet somebody's got to pay for those roads. So costs per person in declining rural areas tend to rise.
Well, I know somebody will want to take a look in much closer detail to everything that's come about from this in this massive study. How can people find it if they're so interested and they want to check it out in more detail?
It will be linked on the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute website. So if you just search for IFPI there, you will find it.
Well, Professor DeBoer, thank you for spending time again with us and talking about a very important topic. And even though, like I said, the COVID-19 pandemic seems to be getting in the way, but we have the recession, as we all know, has come about because of the pandemic, and it's going to have an impact for some time in one way or the other. It's nice to know what we must face in the future here, and maybe some ideas will be passed along, and maybe lawmakers, if they can make the changes, will do so in the future. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Purdue University Professor Larry DeBoer is working with the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute and working on this analysis of the impact of Indiana's tax structure on urban, growing, and rural counties, as well as the impact that the coronavirus has on all of it. This is Regionally Speaking. Indiana public health officials hope that the state's new mask mandate will result in fewer new COVID-19 cases after some record-breaking spikes this month. And the increases are in areas of high concentration of minorities, especially Latinos. Reporter Michael Puente takes us to a city here in northwest Indiana where that's especially true.
Ruth Romero struggles to walk at a park near her home in East Chicago, Indiana. She goes on her daily walks with her daughter and two grandkids most mornings before it gets too hot. Just weeks ago, the idea of walking with her family was unfathomable to Romero.
I was like, okay, what's going on with me? I couldn't walk, I couldn't move, I couldn't pick up my arms, my hands, I couldn't talk. It was crazy. It was scary and crazy.
Romero says she spent 46 days in the hospital, half of them unconscious, and hooked up to a ventilator being treated for COVID-19. She says the symptoms came on fast and strong back in April. Romero lives in this small industrial city off Lake Michigan, where 58% of the 30,000 residents are Latino, primarily of Mexican and Puerto Rican descent. East Chicago's positive COVID-19 rate is the highest in northwest Indiana and among the highest in the entire state.
It's hitting us 2-1 here in East Chicago. It's hitting us 2-1 in the nation. Latins are.
That's Robert Garcia, president of the East Chicago City Council. He says there are a number of factors that are causing the city's rate to be the highest in Lake County, which is second only to the Indianapolis area in positive COVID-19 cases.
Hardest hit communities are your Hispanic and your minority communities, which are poor. They got to go to work.
Garcia's assessment falls in line with a study by the Indiana Health Disparities Task Force that lists a number of factors contributing to higher numbers among Latinos. Factors such as lack of access to free testing sites, the inability for the undocumented population to enroll in Medicaid or other insurance programs for themselves or their children, language barriers. There are also cultural issues. Many Latino families have multi-generation households, making it easier for COVID to spread. And of course, economic barriers. Many who test positive are also frontline workers who can't afford to miss a day of work. Garcia says he's worried his city has almost as many cases as neighboring Gary.
When you go on to population-wise, Gary's twice as big as us, and we might be catching Gary in a couple months.
East Chicago has had more than 700 cases of COVID and 14 deaths. Garcia says members of his own family have tested positive. He says part of the problem is the city administration downplaying the situation and moving too slow.
I don't think there's been a proper response as far as educating the public. So, it's real. This is real.
Diana Garcia Burns heads the East Chicago Health Department. She defends the city's response to the pandemic.
Our numbers are trending upward, but we have more testing sites also. That doesn't excuse the numbers going up because you want people to be negative. But as people tend to gather and more things open, then, they lose that initiative to stay distance.
Burns says the city is pushing people to wear masks and social distance, even though many here want to gather for weddings, car shows, and quinceañeras. Recommendations made by the task force include access to free testing sites and providing PPE to groups who are at risk.
Come on, guys. For a walk.
Walk over on this side. Yep.
Back at the park, Ruth Romero says she thought she had taken all the precautions before getting COVID. One thing she failed to do was wear a mask. She wishes the mask mandate had been in place months ago. Nevertheless, she says she feels lucky to be back with her loved ones.
When I went in, I didn't even get a chance to say bye to them. I didn't even get a chance to hug them and say, I love you. You don't want to end up where I am, where I was. Like I said, just take it seriously.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Michael Puente.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we know there have been some major changes, no thanks to the pandemic, in this year's Indianapolis 500-mile race. And we've asked Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian Donald Davidson, the man who has all of this information packed away in his head, to talk about the fact that the changes that are happening this year are not the first to be encountered in the race's storied history. He'll talk about the others that have happened in the past, the delays and the cancellations, and why. That's on tomorrow's Regionally Speaking, and we hope you'll join us for that.